does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
Scott Agnes is with Fieldhouse Files, joins us on the program on the always busy and shockingly unsponsored guest line. Scott, I'm going to begin with this. The last night's performance by Pascal Siakam, now back-to-back nights, and he has been fabulous. He's been everything that you hoped when they acquired him. Is it situational that we are seeing this, or have we seen, albeit perhaps premature maybe to say this or conclude it, but have we now seen the passing of the torch of the fact that, yes, Tyrese Halliburton is the future of the franchise and the straw mixing the drink, perhaps, but for right now, this is Siakam's team?
I think it'll always be Halliburton's team for a multitude of reasons, but I think what's fair to say is Pascal is kind of the most complete player amongst the group. And what do you need in the postseason, Jake? You need wings, you need playmakers, you need individuals who can just go and get you a bucket, who can just go on a 10-0 run by themselves and completely shift a series. The Pacers really haven't had that. I think we saw glimpses of it recently from Victor Oladipo, but what are we talking about? That was like 5 years ago, 7 years ago. That's something notoriously that they have been without here. And so Pascal, that's where he changes the landscape, the dynamic of this team, and why they were after him for like 18 months.
Scott, this is going to be a question that I ask around the rest of this week, and I'll start with you. Do you think an 8-man rotation is now the permanent answer for them the rest of the series?
I don't, just because things will pop up, and so many times you'll see the most significant changes going from game two to game three when both teams really have more of a sample size, and also they have more times to implement things, right? You know, traveling home yesterday, a practice today, a practice tomorrow, those sorts of things. I think there will be a time when you do have to extend it. What I don't like, though, Jimmy, is when you're throwing 10, 11 different guys out there. It felt like everything in game two was purposeful. Every player knew their role. Every player knew exactly what was being asked of them. They knew what they were expecting in terms of minutes, and for the most part maximized it in terms of even just Obi Toppin and what he was able to get accomplished there in that first half was instrumental.
If they are going to shorten the rotation, whether it ends, because I'm with you, situationally stuff happens, foul trouble happens, fatigue happens. I think Jalen Smith still has minutes available to him as the series goes on, no doubt. But looking at what they did last night, a 14-minute increase for the rookie in Ben Shepherd, who no doubt looked the part in game two, and some would argue with his confidence, he looked it at times in game one. How critical is Shepherd's ability to handle that level of 20-plus minutes in the postseason for them to do what they want to do from a shrinking of the rotation standpoint?
Yeah, you're going to need that, because I view him much like an Aaron Nesmith, is they don't need to be spectacular at either end. They just need to be solid and reliable, right? So if Ben can come in, Shepherd can come in and knock down two threes and defend and hold his own at that end, that is his role. That is what is being asked of him right now, just like Andrew Nembhard. Like, he had a quiet 20 points seemingly in game two, but if he could just knock down a couple three-pointers and hold his own a little bit with Damian Lillard and quiet him down a little bit more, that's what they're really asking of Andrew Nembhard. So in terms of the bench and what you're trying to see there, I think this is about what it is, though you might see another player get a different spot minutes, just depending on what things are called upon. And I specifically think about the big wild card in all this, and it even goes back to Jake's first question about Pascal. Who would be guarding him, presumably, if Giannis is out there? It'd be Giannis, I think, right? That's probably the matchup we'd see, and so things would not be coming as easily as they seem to right now. Or you'd throw length, you'd throw athleticism on him to slow him down, and the same would go for the Pacers as well. They might need another body or two to foul him or just slow him down a little bit. But it doesn't seem like to me that Giannis is even close to returning right now. I think he's probably at least a week away.
Yeah, I got the impression Giannis would be back when they come here Friday. But you don't think he plays Friday or Sunday?
Just based on what we're hearing, Jake, and then Doc Rivers, all he would elaborate before the game yesterday was that he was on the floor and he got shots up. Well, we all know, first of all, he hadn't played in almost 3 weeks. Therefore, you lose your game shape, your game rhythm. And if he's not cutting, if he's not running up and down the floor, and if he's not doing even like 3-on-3 with some interns, like, that would be a little bit alarming to me to be then thrust into a postseason game. And by the way, this injury is concerning for several reasons. Most notably is that left side of his has been, in my non-doctoral way, just tight all year. It's been Achilles, it's been a calf strain, it's been a hamstring, and any player will tell you they are all connected. You feel them, and if one tweaks, there is a much higher risk for the next thing to go wrong.
This sounds like a 51-year-old sports radio host after taking a red eye. For what that's worth, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Scott Agnes is our guest, Fieldhouse Files, talking about the Pacers-Bucks last night, Game 1. In the fourth quarter, I guess you could say, like, I thought the Pacers broke Milwaukee. Now, is that series breaking them? No, but I just watched, like, body language of Milwaukee, and in the second half of that fourth quarter, as soon as Indiana pushed it back up into double digits, you could tell, and they broke the will of the Bucks last night, which is saying something, because that's a team with a pretty strong resolve.
Yeah, I would agree. It was after that initial rush in the first or in the fourth quarter. It was about 90 seconds. Then the Pacers kind of settled in after a Rick Carlisle timeout. Remember, he had to use like three of them in the first quarter, I think it was last game. Just a much different poise and demeanor and comfortability, I think, was visible from the Pacers side of things. But that 23-4 run is absolutely what flipped it. And during that rush, it felt like the Bucks got outside themselves, to your point, Jake. It looked like they got away from what had worked, were settling from shots, did not get within their offense. And really throughout the game, what helped the Pacers is they were able to get out and run a lot more and resemble the team that we saw more so from the regular season.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Scott, I'm not going to put this in trivia form, which is unusual for me, and thus, like, stall everything uncomfortably, okay? So I'll just put this to you in a statement that I gave earlier, and I'm going to continue to, like, push this narrative because I'm a big believer in it, but I want you to tell me if I'm off base. So you're basically going to be my program director here, right? And you're going to say,
okay,
Jake, listen. I thought Andrew Nembhard last night was sensational, defensively in particular. I thought he played really well. I thought Toppin gave them good minutes. We mentioned Ben Shepherd. But the guy to me that continues to be a stabilizing force of making all of the right plays and always being in the right spot at the right time.
I know where you're going.
And I go back to when Nembhard got his technical foul, the guy that had the presence of mind to immediately get in the middle and be like, whoa, whoa, whoa,
yep,
like, let's just get the guy that seems to always gather things under control is Aaron Nesmith. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. Just does the little things. I mean, to have the poise in those moments, and it wasn't just Nembhard, it was someone else. Forget what it was.
I think it was Toppin at one point, maybe.
Maybe it was Toppin, yeah, because later he did get a technical. Yeah, Nesmith read the situation, said, no, it's not worth it. Wrapped them both up in a good way and moved them away from the scene, saying, nope, not on my watch. I'm not allowing that to happen. And then the other primary thing that they're asking of him, of course, is to manage Chris Middleton, who only had 15 points, was just okay in 37 minutes. He's just kind of having one of those careers derailed at the end because of injuries, much like we see out west with Klay Thompson as well. But Nesmith's got to do that. He's a versatile defender. And I continue to repeat, he's about to start a new contract. Before the season, the front office did a tremendous job to get him to re-sign 3 years, $33 million. That's 11 per. He's easily outplaying that value.
Scott Agnes is our guest. You can find his work on Fieldhouse Files. Scott, when you look at Tyrese Halliburton in the playoffs, and it's only a two-game sample size, so it's hard for me to go as far as to say that you can definitively have an answer for who he's going to be in the postseason. But when you look at these first two games, how much of his inability to score at will like he did at stretches during the regular season is because it's the playoffs and the way that he's being played is not going to allow him to do that, and he's going to be better off passing or utilizing in the flow of the offense? And how much of that is what I've seen multiple times now, anytime he tries to get free in off-dribble motion, he's doubled and he has to make the right pass versus forcing a bad shot?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of that. It's him as the point guard and his having his terrific vision. It's him reading the room and reading the situation here and saying, I'm being a decoy as much as anything right now. He did get up a few more shots. I'd still like to see that a little bit more, especially when he's making 3 of 7 from three-point range. But, Jimmy, so much of it goes down to the defensive scheme and what they're doing to him. They're picking up full court. And, by the way, I give Pacers credit, too. That was one of their minor adjustments that I think went a long way, is they wanted to tire out this Milwaukee Bucks team. So they were picking up full court. And I'm not just talking one guy. It was multiple guys just extending themselves. And that's why I think, to Jake's point earlier, they just were uncomfortable, the Bucks were, and exhausted and played outside themselves. But, Jimmy, with this, you're seeing the Bucks scheme Halliburton a little bit out of the game, which is exactly what good teams do in the postseason. You try to minimize their influence, and he still got the assist. And that in large part because teammates were making the shots that they were missing last game. But you would still like to see him be a little bit more assertive. But I connect what he's doing right now a little bit to what Buddy Hield was doing as a Pacer, that he's so impactful even if he's not shooting or even if he's not making shots, because of the gravity in which the defending team has to guard him and be aware of every movement of his and send two guys necessarily. But, yes, I would agree he's not – the 100% or the guy that we fully expect in the postseason.
Are we safe to say that two games is not enough to be able to say, yeah, he's not a playoff scorer, just send doubles at him and he's not going to be a threat in that way? Is it too early to say that?
That is far too early, especially considering, as much as I hate going back to it, you talked about maybe, you know, how he's trying to elude the pressure and get around it. We still haven't seen that complete burst from him since that injury. Now, I think that's mostly behind him, but I'm very curious what he'll look like even next season once he's fully healed from that, even though we don't exactly know how he feels.
Scott, what did you – I guess I should say not what did you make of, but what do you anticipate the perhaps storyline being, if anything, moving forward – with Tyrese Halliburton's post-game comments that his brother was – that a racial slur was used towards his brother at the game and towards Halliburton's family, and, of course, they being natives of Wisconsin in Milwaukee, and Halliburton commenting on that last night. Do you think that's that, or do you think we will hear more of this story?
I think – for the most part, that's probably that, and him sharing it and sharing his disappointment and frustration and whatever he and his family have been feeling, especially because it's his home in Wisconsin. It's not like it's in the Boston Garden, where, as bad as it is, you kind of expect it. Like, it's an awful thing. But
never expect that. But yes, I get what you're saying.
We've heard so many players talk about their experiences, is what I should say.
Right, right. You should never tolerate it. How's that? And I'm not saying that's what you're saying, right?
No doubt. But to do it in, let's call it, his backyard in Wisconsin, I think probably hits him where it hurts even more. And then to have his family sitting right there courtside with him throughout the game. Yeah, it's absolutely unacceptable. And it speaks to just a multitude of layers that these players deal with throughout games, whether it's an issue at home or it's something their family's feeling or something he had to address early. You know, between games, let's say, I'm sure that was an ongoing conversation with maybe the coaching staff, team security, and just to make sure he felt his most comfortable self out on the court when his family perhaps felt threatened or uncomfortable.
Scott, I just think that there is, and I mentioned this earlier, I hope it's a 0.05%, right? But I do think that there are some people that feel that because they paid big money for big – and I don't even mean the NBA. I'm just talking in general, sports in general. you get people that if you mix super expensive tickets with alcohol,
yep,
you get an entitlement and an arrogance of people that the filter of understanding common decency for some of these people goes totally out the window. And they think that they're allowed to do it. And it's got to stop.
It could, yeah, you're exactly right. It should not be tolerated. On top of that, it doesn't seem like it's it seems like it's more shifted, much like Tyrese has even talked about. And by the way, I give him credit for opening up and being comfortable enough to share this stuff, because I think it's a little bit vulnerable. And he would probably, or some players would try to maybe keep it more private. But Tyrese even opened up earlier in the year how he, as a player, sometimes just feels like a game prop in terms of gambling out there. And you sit courtside, you probably hear it more than anyone of guys, you know, hey, Draymond, I need two more rebounds. Come on.
Right. Like, no, you're
I got
right.
$100 on the game. And it's like, that to me should also not be tolerated. Maybe you get a warning, but after that, no, that has no place in this league in terms of, are you trying to influence the game? Are you trying to influence the bet in terms of that?
Although, Scott, to be fair, and I agree with you, right, and we've talked about this on this show, especially like with college athletes and the prop betting and the Pandora's box there. I agree with you. However, you know, it's when people would say, hey, you know, Drew Brees, I just need one more touchdown for my fantasy team. Everybody thought it was cute and funny, right? And it's kind of the same. It's a slippery slope, right?
Yeah, I think you can tell the tone, right? So if you're coming out of halftime.
That's fair.
And you're joking with Obi Toppin, hey, man, great first half. Let's get one more rebound. All right, that's kind of jovial, funny, not much to it. Now, if you'll see the tone change. And you'll see, watch these NBA games. Watch the first row and guys courtside. They will jump up and celebrate the most meaningless thing. And that's how they reveal themselves. It might be the over-under for a game, and it hits in a 20-point blowout, or it might just be like a reserve player grabbing a rebound. That guy reveals himself, and that, to me, is different than just joking around. And it's probably a tick of a fan just like, I don't know what to say. It's a star player here. I'll just congratulate him on a good first half.
Scott Agnes, find all his work at Fieldhouse Files. Scott, looking forward to following along the rest of the way. Thanks, as always, for making time for us, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks, guys.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
The Killers, the first concert to take place at Fiserv Arena last night. It was a concert, a brilliant maestro performance by the Indiana Pacers in Milwaukee, a guy that's a native of America's Dairyland, Joel Erickson, talking about the... That is a true story. Look it up. That's a true story. The maniacal laugh of Joel A. Erickson, who joins us from the Indianapolis Star. Joel, are you a Bucks fan? I knew you grew up... I know that you grew up in Wisconsin, and you like the Brewers. I'm assuming you grew up a Packers fan as well. What about the Bucks?
The Bucks are the only Wisconsin team that I cannot and have not ever claimed. When I was a kid, my favorite athlete was David Robinson, and so I grew up a Spurs fan.
Okay, that's cool. And you, for what reason did you choose David Robinson, who is a very, you know, very worthy player to have, be your favorite, but what was the reasoning there?
There was just like a whole bunch of he was super, super smart. Like there was an alto sax tradition in the Erickson family that he played that. There's just a whole bunch of David Robinson things. The faith piece of it, I like that too. There were a whole bunch of David Robinson things. But like I was a David Robinson guy when I was five. I don't even know if I like.
Did you have braces when you were a kid?
I did not, no.
Yeah, David Robinson had braces, I think, like in his rookie year in the NBA. He's got a very nice smile now. That's probably why. Joel, you said David Robinson's a very smart guy. I don't disagree with that. If David Robinson, with all of his intelligence, was asked who the Indianapolis Colts are going to select in the draft, he would say who?
The smart bet is a corner, I think. Well, wide receiver is obviously a need. They keep talking about the depth of it, and also they're sort of a, if you're sitting at 15, they're kind of sitting in a spot where I mean, if you believe the you know, media draft analysts, which is all we really have right now. We don't have access to the Colts board, despite much requesting from me and other members of the Colts media corps. It feels like there's a spot there. It's in a spot where the top three receivers will be gone. The top corner will be available. I know Chris Ballard talked a lot about how much he likes the guys they have, and I think he does. I don't think he's lying about that. But also, I've been covering him for a while, and he said that about a lot of positions, and then immediately drafted that position as soon as the draft opened in prior years. So I'm leaning cornerback based on those factors.
Joel, I don't know how much of this is just speculation on his end and how much of it is, okay, this means that these are rumors or buzz that has happened, but I saw this earlier today. I had a conversation with my producer, Eddie Garrison, about it as well, but Daniel Jeremiah tweeted about a couple hours ago in regards to the latest, perhaps, of teams that could be in on fit from a salary standpoint and fit from a schematic standpoint, Brandon Ayuk out of San Francisco, that the Colts and the Jaguars are who he keeps coming back to as teams that could be suitors for that. When you look at that idea, A, is it the first that you're hearing that, or B, does that track in terms of conversation that you've had, and B, would that be the right fit and the type of aggressive move that I think they need to take to further enhance the development of Anthony Richardson?
I think I've heard it speculated. I don't know that there's anything. Well, we've learned this the hard way this offseason, right? That there's a difference between speculation and something actually going on. I've heard it speculated. There's this thing that happens with the Colts a lot where people look at their depth chart and go, "Oh, that could definitely happen there." They need another wide receiver. They've already paid Michael Pittman a $23 million in average salary over the next 3 years. If you trade for Ayuk, you're presumably paying 25. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, but if the receiver class is as deep as everyone says it is, and that's not just Chris Ballard. I remember back at the combine, that was basically every GM was saying, you can get a good, there's so many good receivers in this draft. From a resource allocation standpoint, it's absolutely a big swing. I just don't know in terms of picks plus salary plus how much you're paying the wide receiver position at that point, if it's maybe the best idea when you could maybe get another receiver on a rookie contract and fill that spot that way.
Joel A. Erickson of the Indianapolis Star is our guest. He joins us now on the always busy but shockingly unsponsored guest line. Joel, I decided, because I'm a nice guy, that I was going to get you a spotted cow. Last time I was in Wisconsin, I brought you back a spotted cow. And then last night after the Pacers game, I decided to celebrate with the spotted cow that I was going to get you. And so I cracked it open. And I've had it for a while, and lo and behold, a guest who had a question for you came out. Here we go.
It is correct. Robin the Genie, I was in the bottle. Thank you for rescuing me.
Oh, gosh.
Joel A. Erickson, I have a question for you. I am going to give you $1 million if you can answer the following question correct. Will the Indianapolis Colts select at the number 15 position? If you say yes, actually, I'll give you $1,000 if correct. But if you say no and they adhere to your prediction, you will get $1 million. Which would you say is the correct answer?
Is Joel still there? I can't hear. I lost my headset.
I'm still here. The yes and the no part, I'm confused.
So
by
Robin is saying he's giving you like 100,000 to one odds. If they draft 15th, you get $1,000. If they don't, if you select it and you say no, they're going to trade out of 15, you get $1 million. Would you take those odds? Would you go with it, or would you say no? I am so certain that they're going to draft at 15 that I'm taking that.
I think I'd take the trade out.
So you think there is still the possibility that they do not draft at 15?
Yeah.
Do you think that's because they would be moving up, or because Chris Ballard says, you know what, I love draft capital, I want additional second rounders?
More likely that he loves draft capital. He wants additional second rounders. And they did say the other day that they had 19 to 21 first round grades on their board.
In that event, they want to stick at 15, right?
In theory, but you could also go backwards and still get a first round graded player in that case. I also just think, you know, he's always proven that he likes to move down and get more picks. You know, they only have 7. That's a low number for him. I feel like there's a good chance that if somebody wants to move up, that he'd be very willing to listen.
Joel, I just want to let you know that, not to let your decision get swayed, but Robin doesn't have a good history of paying, so you might think yes to insure $1,000.
Robin,
that doesn't mean that's coming to you.
It is true that Robin's up to his rear in arrears. There's no question about that, but that's okay.
He's been doing more than just sitting in the bottle. I think he's consuming some of the bottle while he's in there as well. Joel, for the Colts, from a need standpoint, whether it's trading back or whether it is making selections on day 2, where do you think their mindset changes? Let's say, just for the sake of ease with that conversation, they made the pick at 15, so there was no trade back, there was no additional assets. Day 2, how much movement do you expect from them while following what they want from their board?
They usually move on day 2. Moved up for Jonathan Taylor, moved up for Nick Cross. They've moved down before. Like, there's usually a move on day 2 at some point, one way or the other. And I think that's very possible again. Once you get into the second round, like the Jonathan Taylor trade, they moved up 3 spots and all they gave up for it was a fifth round pick. And so the prices in terms of what it takes to move come down a little bit. You can also pick up picks, which Ballard loves to do. I do think there's probably a move. They're going to trade. They're going to trade at least a couple times. I feel like that's pretty true just about every draft. They are not a standing pick team. There's not a ton of those around the NFL either. These picks get traded left and right the entire draft, basically.
Joel A. Erickson of the Indianapolis Star is our guest. Joel, is there a player that you could see? Let's say the Colts stick at 15, okay? Is there a player that may be so eye-popping that it forces Chris Ballard to go away from need and simply go, I went best player available because this guy was there and we could not pass him up. We will make room for him.
I think there are 2, if you look at need from a number standpoint. The number 1 is Dallas Turner, the pass rusher from Alabama. What I like to call a war daddy edge rusher, that superstar pass rusher off the edge, is something Ballard has basically spent his entire Colts career trying to get. Turner seems to fit his priors in terms of what he wants the most. He's expected to go far before 15, but I think that he would definitely go away from need. They don't need it from a number standpoint. They've got lots of defensive linemen, but they also, you know, pursued Danielle Hunter in free agency. So they clearly still want that spot. That's one. And then the other one, and this is more of a need from a positional number standpoint, it's a need more from how they want the offense to run than a positional number standpoint, because they have lots of young tight ends. They have lots of young developmental tight ends. Jelani Woods, Will Mallory, Kylan Granson is still fairly young. Like, they have lots of guys like that. Brock Bowers from Georgia, they've kind of talked a little bit throughout the offseason about wanting guys who can get yards after the catch. And Brock Bowers is that. Brock Bowers is that. He gives you that. That's who he was at Georgia. He's the type of guy that I could see them going, well, look, we've got all these tight ends, but this guy gives the offense what it needs, and therefore we're going to make that pick. So that would be a quote-unquote need pick in terms of what the offense needs over, you know, they don't necessarily need a tight end from a number standpoint. They have plenty of guys there.
Joel A. Erickson is our guest, Colts insider for the Indianapolis Star. Joel, we had a conversation with JP Shadrick of Jaguars.com yesterday in regards to where the board was for Jacksonville, and they arguably have the same clear need, at least in one spot on their depth chart, that the Colts do, which is cornerback. Now, the Jaguars pick two picks later than the Colts do, with the Colts selection coming at 15, but there's still that thought of trading up to go get your guy. The Colts did not do that last year to get Anthony Richardson or any other quarterback. They were confident that their guy would be there at 4, but with there being a handful of top-end cornerbacks that could go around the same range as their selection, will the Colts be tempted to trade up, whether it's to battle with a chess move with Jacksonville or just parry their way over other teams to ensure they were to get somebody like a Quinion Mitchell or a Terrion Arnold?
I think that if you want a corner and you're in range to jump the Colts, I think you're probably looking, just looking at depth charts, regardless of what the Colts have said, just looking at depth charts, I would say like the Eagles are a team that I think most people are reporting want a corner and are obviously very aggressive. Like I would think that those teams are probably, you know, circling the Colts as the team they need to get in front of.
What I'm asking is, to preempt that, would the Colts then need to look at the same and circle teams ahead, maybe not in that top 10 range, but inside of that space from 10 to 14, maybe there's a trade partner to get them up a couple spots to ensure they get their guy? Is that something that is in the, I don't want to say the mantra, but in the playbook of Chris Ballard and company to ensure they get the corner they want to fit their system?
I think that they would do it, like I think they would do it if they don't have to move much. I think it's more likely that they feel like they have several options, and if it's going to take a big jump by some other team to get up, that the Colts are not going to
they won't play defense on that. They'll just let
it
play.
They haven't really done that in the first round before. A trade up, the thing with a trade up is just, I mean, I know it's, you can always say no one's ever done something until they've never done until they do it. But Chris Ballard has never traded up in the first round. He's traded down several times, and the move up and what it takes in the first round in terms of capital, it would be very surprising. I would be very surprised to see them do that. Just given his history, it would honestly be the most interesting thing they could do was to move up in the first round and give up a pick of significant value, just from a standpoint of it would be a departure from what they've done. But it's so unlike what they've done in the past that I would be pretty surprised if that's what happens.
Joel, let me run past you a scenario, and then you tell me, and I've run this past a lot of people, but now, are you getting emails? Is your computer shutting down? Is everything going okay?
My computer is giving me emails or something.
It's not running thermal checks on an Indigo bus, is it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Everything going okay, though?
I don't think so. Yeah, it's okay. Just, you know, just decided to make noise in the middle of an interview for reason.
We've had worse happen on here this week.
Yeah, I have a cat that does that, so that's fine. And you know, your coworker, Zach, is it Osterman or Osterman? Do we know yet? Which is it Osterman?
Yes, that was Osterman.
Osterman?
I think it's Osterman, yeah.
He had a dog, Chewy. Chewy was a good boy. Chewy liked to let himself be known when he was doing interviews, too. So it's all good. I mean, we got no problem.
You guys are in the middle of the day, so normally it's my kids that make appearances on the radio.
Jake, you weren't here, but Dustin Dupirak on Monday, well, another one of our fun names of which way do you say it, he was basically in a wind tunnel, had to seek shelter on the side of a wall to be able to avoid the clear squall that was coming through wherever he was in Milwaukee.
We have it all on this show, right? Joel, it's amazing the things you guys will do to get out of doing this conversation, right?
My youngest son, Watley, the 1 year old, he's made several appearances on Bowen and Andy's show. Several.
Watley.
Yes.
That's a cool name. Were you also a fan of Enos Watley along with David Robinson back in your NBA viewing days?
Watley is my wife's grandmother's maiden name.
Very cool.
That's cool. How Watley came.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So let me run past you this scenario, though, and you tell me if you think there's any chance this happens. You ready?
Yeah.
The following phone call or the following voicemail, okay?
Chris, you know, it's Jim here, and like I was thinking, you know, I mean, the band, you know, we couldn't get the band together in L.A. because, you know, I was in the hospital and stuff, but we're going to get the band together and with the former players, and I want you to get Marvin Harrison Jr., you know, and just do what you got to do because his dad's in the Ring of Honor, so you just, you know, make that happen for me. What are the odds that that insinuation or hint takes place?
I think fairly low, 5%.
But you can't say zero, right?
I can't say zero, but I would say pretty low. I would think pretty low. One of the things that sticks out to me over the last couple of years is just, you know, how much support Jim Irsay has for the way Chris Ballard handles and builds his roster. I think that, you know, Ballard obviously went on the Rich Eisen show last week and said that, you know, when he thinks about trading up for Marvin Harrison Jr. in a fantasy land. I would guess that as much as it would be fun to bring Marvin Harrison Jr. to the spot that Marvin Harrison Sr. played, just going off of those conversations in the past, I think that Irsay is much more supportive of the way Ballard handles the draft and the roster than maybe some of the fans.
But here's the thing, though, Joel, and I'm not saying, look, in this situation, this is what I think, and I don't know, people can let me know if I'm misjudging here, okay? But I get the feeling that this fan base, okay, that this fan base when it comes to Chris Ballard, 54-60-1, one playoff win, that this fan base when it comes to Chris Ballard and it comes to the Indianapolis Colts sits around and is like, you know what? If there's a guy that is going to make your team better, that is a guy that you want, that is a guy that makes sense, that is a guy that people want, go get him. Like every other team, when they pinpoint somebody, they make moves and they go get them. And the Colts instead, like, fall back and pick up, like, three more third-round linemen. Okay, great. Like, I think the passiveness, it quite frankly, I think people here in this town are over it. I think they're done with it. And I think they actually would want for me or for Jimmy or for Kevin or Andy or whatever to be the ones to carry the responsibility of standing on the platform and saying, do something. Quit talking about it. Do it. If the guy is somebody that you want to go get him. Now, is that too harsh, and is that harder to do than just simply going and doing it?
I would agree with you on the fan base, and like I would say, you know, specifically with the edge rusher, the absolute, you know, big time edge rusher. I think that's something I've been talking about for 5 years around this time of the year, that they should go get one. And make sure they get one in some form or the other. It's just not been how they operate. I mean, free agency this year to me was another signal that the way they operate is the way they operate, and regardless of how, you know, the outside world feels, that they're going to stick with that. Because I heard, you know, we have flexibility with the rookie quarterback contract and thought, oh, we might see something like the Buckner move, which is the real outlier in the whole free agency trade thing coming this year. And it didn't happen. You know, they have two outside free agents right now. From a should they do it standpoint, I think that there absolutely is a huge case to be made that going up and getting a player that they are convinced is going to be a Pro Bowl type player who takes them to the next level would be a great move. It's just from a beat writer realistic, this is how like what are they going to do standpoint. Free agency sort of has me beaten down to the point that it's like that they're going to operate the way they operate, and anything else would be a surprise to me at this point.
Joel, I realize this is not your position to say this because it's where the lines get blurred between journalist, beat writer, and, you know, opining talk show host, but at some point the line has to be drawn from this is what they're doing to what they're doing is not the right thing to do. And that's where a lot of the frustration comes from our end, is at some point, when is it not acceptable for it to be, oh, well, that's just what Chris Ballard does, versus Chris Ballard's doing the wrong thing? And I wonder when that winds up happening. I won't make you opine on that directly because, again, it's not necessarily your place for that, but I feel like that is a lot of the confusion on the fans base standpoint. As we're 24 hours from the draft, what other pieces can we look forward to? Can Colts fans look forward to on your end covering the draft on IndyStar.com?
Well, I think, you know, we've got a lot of stuff that's sort of mock drafty coming out. We haven't done this yet, but Nate and I always do a simulated mock draft, which I kind of like better than the actual mock draft because I can do whatever
now,
I want.
Now, wait a minute. Now, I'm curious about this. Hang on just a second. Simulated mock draft. Now, that's redundant, yeah. Is it not?
Yeah, probably.
So you're simulating a simulation.
Does it become a simulation when you have multiple people involved? Is that when it gets upgraded?
No, it has to do with the process of doing it. The way most people do mock drafts is you just decide that a player is available there and give it to your team and make whatever picks have to happen to get there. Whereas, like, the way we do it is we'll get on a simulator and the only team we can make a pick for is the Colts.
Right. You can't influence what else happens.
It's more like the real draft where you don't have control over what everybody else is doing.
So now listen to this, Joel.
You have to react as it happens.
I realize I'm interrupting, but I have to share this because you'll appreciate this then because it sounds like what you're talking about. So there's a different radio station, I'm not going to say any names, in a different market, okay? And every year they call me and they go, do you want to make the Colts pick for our mock draft? And I go, okay. So the way they do it is this year – I was the 15th person, okay? So they do this over the course of several days. And they send me, and they have like the, I don't know, who drafts 14th? I don't even know who's right in front of Indianapolis.
The Saints, I think.
Okay, so they had like a guy from New Orleans that did the 14th pick. So they have everybody literally from each respective market making the selection that their team would take in that spot. And then they send me, okay, here are the available players that would be available in this simulation, right? So in that capacity, I take a wide receiver for the Colts, and then instantly these guys are like, what a moron. They need a tight end. And I'm like, well, the tight end's gone. You already told me. The guy from like Cleveland took him. Like, what are we doing here? And then they tweet out, Jake Query of Indianapolis has selected Brian Thomas Jr., wide receiver LSU for the Colts. And like, everybody's torching me about what a moron I am. And I'm like, well, wait a minute.
You weren't there.
Right.
You weren't in the room.
Like, I was in the war room, right? My gosh. Anyway, so I feel Chris Ballard's pain, but I also am not 54-60-1 with one playoff win and wearing flat-brimmed hats and telling everybody I'm smarter than they are. Anyway, as you were, Joel.
The flat-brimmed hat thing is like my son's baseball team I have a hat for because I'm helping coach, and the only options for fitted hats were flat brims, and I absolutely found a way to put a curve in mine, and I prefer curved brim hats anyway, the normal brim hat anyway, but also in the back of my head is if I wear a flat brimmed hat and I run into Jake somewhere, I'm never going to be able to live it down.
Well, here's the thing. I myself, and listen, I am the kid. I don't know if you know this or not, Joel. This is going to be shocking to you. I love me some me, right? Like, I actually, you know what I mean? I'm not going to lie to you. Occasionally, I'll walk past a mirror, and I kind of get turned on, okay? Now, having said that, and I also, for years, I mean, I'm 51 years old, and it was easily, I think 48 and a half when my heart decided to shut down was about the time I realized I wasn't 25, right? And so I get it. I totally understand it. And I do kind of enjoy wearing, I mean, I like baseball hats. I wear a lot of hats. But I thank Chris Ballard because that was the first time that illuminated to me that at 51, the flat brim, not working, right? Now I might be able to pull it off because I look good. But it looks silly, right? Am I wrong?
I don't have the head for it. Like my head.
Now, you know who does. Have you met Eddie Garrison, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if you noticed it. When you were a kid, did you ever go to a planetarium?
I don't know if I did or not.
Well, if you've ever seen Jupiter, you've met Eddie. That's all I'll say. Right? Anyway.
Man.
Eddie's telling me we're rapping. Listen, it took 30 minutes, but we got that sinister, maniacal laugh out of you, Joel.
That one got me for sure.
Yeah, hey, thanks.
Poor Eddie.
Poor Eddie indeed.
Joel, it's going to be a busy 48 hours for you. We appreciate the time, man. We'll talk to you soon, all right?
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Joel A. Erickson of the Indianapolis Star.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Joining us now on the program, and I'm sure thrilled to be doing so based on that intro, Jonathan Alexander is with the Houston Chronicle. We talked yesterday about what Jacksonville may do in the draft. We're trying to get an idea of what's happening around the Colts of those teams they're going to be competing with for a while. And Jonathan, I'll begin with this. Outsider perspective would be that obviously C.J. Stroud probably accelerated like the makeover timeline. In other words, you know, his arrival last year, it was like, whoa, wait a minute, maybe we can push forward a little bit more aggressively than was anticipated because he was so good, so immediate. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Nick Caserio, the general manager of the Texans, won't publicly admit that no matter how many times we ask him, but that is exactly what's happening. You know, nobody foresaw the Texans moving this quick, winning this quickly. But since they have won, they've made moves that signify a team that wants to win a Super Bowl, and everybody I talk to around the building say that D'Amico Ryans is steadfast on winning a Super Bowl. Again, like you said, they have the pieces. They have the quarterback who has shown he is a franchise guy, and you try to maximize that window while he's still in that rookie contract, and that's what the Texans are doing.
Jonathan, when the Texans go out and they acquire Stephon Diggs and it looks like that it's going to be a multi-year matrimony type deal and the Texans now have the, you know, shiny new toy within a division, and then a couple days or weeks, whatever the timeline was later, it comes out that they restructured and it's only a one-year deal. What does that mean for both parties involved now, weeks removed from when that happened? And is Diggs at that point, obviously it's kind of a contract year for him effectively, so it's an audition year for him. Is this just a one-off, or is there potential for this to be a, okay, we'll revisit it and maybe extend you to a longer contract at the end of the season?
I think all options are on the table, but I think the way the Texans see it is they see Stephon Diggs right now as a short-term rental, somebody who's playing in a contract year who will have incentive to play really well, who will give them the opportunity to have multiple weapons. I think Nico Collins is definitely in their future and somebody that they'll have to pay a lot of money to. Unless Stephon Diggs were to be the most model of wide receivers there is, along with the production, and show that he has a number of several years to go, you know, I do think this is a short-term marriage that could potentially turn into something longer. But I think that they would like him to fill a particular hole right now and help them win what they believe that they can win the Super Bowl.
Does that win now mentality for them transfer to trading back into the first round without a first round pick now? Does that involve trading up to get another piece?
I think that they would trade up into the first round only if they saw one of their targets drop down. And I think a potential target could be Johnny Newton. If he were to fall late into the first round or even early into the second round, then I think the Texans could trade up. But when you look at what it would take to trade up into the first round, it would take a lot of draft capital that the Texans aren't really necessarily willing to part ways with, because they're going to have to tie up a lot of money in a lot of their players in the coming years, namely Derek Stingley, Nico Collins, of course, C.J. Stroud when he's eligible in a couple of years. So they got a lot of money, and Will Anderson as well with that fifth-year option in a couple of years. They got a lot of money. They got to pay a lot of their young guys. I don't think they want to give up a lot of draft capital right now.
Jonathan, one of the things when it comes to – Jonathan Alexander is our guest from the Houston Chronicle. When it comes to building rosters around a franchise quarterback, you know, in Indianapolis there is somewhat of a blueprint and a precedent, right? And one of the things that I thought was brilliant that they did with Peyton Manning, and I think they did it to an extent with Luck, but more so with Manning, was they made sure that all the weapons around him – were hitting stride at the same time. There wasn't staggered, like, this guy's on his way out, this guy's over the cliff. Everybody, I mean, Edgerrin James, Peyton Manning, Reggie Wayne, Dallas Clark, they all were hitting their prime simultaneously. Is Houston equipped to do that, or do they have kind of a Dow Jones line in terms of age and window for roster?
Yeah, I think you do see Houston doing that. You look at who their weapons are. We know Stephon Diggs is one of the top five receivers in the league. Nico Collins was one of the better emerging receivers, finished with 1,297 receiving yards. That is elite, almost elite level. I think he's along the lines of Michael Pittman there in that same group. And then you look at Tank Dell, who was well on his way to a 1,000-yard receiving season in his first year before he got hurt. They have multiple guys, and Dalton Schultz as well. They have multiple guys who could get the job done, and they're all young, under 30, except Stephon Diggs, who is 30. So they have a lot of young guys who are coming into their prime, and they're going to be going along with C.J. Stroud.
Where is the ceiling and the floor for another electric weapon that they have? And his battle through leukemia was well documented during his rookie season. But I've always been, even to the Alabama days, fascinated with John Mechie, and I'm still waiting for him to get his full-scale opportunity. Where is the offseason outlook for him for what he could be in his next season now with the Texans?
Yeah, we talked to C.J. Stroud a couple of weeks ago, and he pointed out John Mechie multiple times, unprompted, and said he looked great in the throwing session with him, looked healthier. You think about it with John Mechie, last year was technically his first year, his rookie year, and he was, you know, having come off that battle of leukemia, didn't practice at all during his rookie season. He was sometimes in the weight room, but it was really his first season, and it takes a lot for a rookie to get adjusted, and I think John Mechie was trying to figure out where he fit in to a new offense. It was a brand new offense that he was learning as well. So I think this year, with the comfortability with C.J. Stroud and maybe some potential opportunities that may come available, I think John Mechie could be in line for definitely a more improved year than he had last year.
Jonathan Alexander is our guest from the Houston Chronicle, talking about the Texans as we get set for the draft. Texans' first pick, 59th overall, is their first selection, right, Jonathan, as it stands right now?
42.
Okay, sorry. So, no first rounder. Obviously, they've been aggressive in the last couple of years. I'm curious, and I realize, Jonathan, your focus is the Texans. I mean, I get and respect that. But I always get fascinated by asking out-of-market perceptions of Indianapolis, because we live in a snow globe here, right? So When you look at the Colts, your overall perception of where they are, where they slot in terms of teams that Houston would worry about within the AFC South and the pecking order, if you will, just your overall thoughts on the Colts.
Yeah, I think the Colts, you know, took on a different strategy with the Texans as far as, you know, they brought in a lot of their pieces that they grew and signed a lot of them. Texans got a lot of new pieces. When I look at the Colts, one of the weaknesses they have definitely is that outside cornerback position. It was definitely a struggle. From the standpoint of what we saw, of course, in that playoff game, Nico Collins just kind of went off. Colts seem like they need some secondary help. Haven't paid too much attention to what exactly they got outside of their regular guys in free agency, but yeah, they basically just stayed
the course in free agency, kept their own, and yeah, they didn't get overly aggressive spending elsewhere.
Yeah, so I would think that the Colts would target a cornerback with one of their first picks, or even an outside edge rusher, because their wide receivers are, I think Michael Pittman and Josh Downs, I watched him play throughout his college career. I think he's going to be a phenomenal type player, and of course the Colts have Richardson, who is, I think, if he can stay healthy, can be phenomenal too. I think focusing on the defense will probably make a lot of sense for the Colts.
Jonathan, we've seen multiple times the last couple of years, it feel like the balance of power in the AFC South has definitively shifted to one team. For the last couple of years, it's been Jacksonville, and then Houston has that breakout year with C.J. Stroud last year, to the point that they are picked by many not only as the front runners to win the South, but I mean, I've seen even before the Diggs trade, some people have them, whether it just to make a sexy pick or not, as a dark horse to represent the AFC in the Super Bowl next year. As you cover this beat, whether it's organizationally, whether it's the fan base, what is the overall vibe going into not just the draft, but next season, knowing that it's been at least 5 years, right, since they were up?
Yeah.
Three touchdowns on Kansas City in the divisional round. It's been 5 years since Houston has felt this good about their football team.
Yeah, I mean, you look at Houston last year, they went to the divisional round against the Ravens, won a playoff game, and with a roster that was very young in the sense that they had a rookie quarterback And they got to piece together their roster. They spent a little bit more than they had in previous years, but it wasn't like a huge offseason. Then they went into this offseason, they felt like they improved. They got better with Danielle Hunter on the outside. They added, of course, Stephon Diggs and Joe Mixon at running back. So the Texans are a better team on paper than they were last year. They just have to stay healthy. And I think they believe that they are capable of competing with the Ravens and the Chiefs. Now, competing with the Chiefs and winning and getting to Super Bowls is easier said than done. They're an elite franchise, and it'd be hard to take them down. But the Texans at least feel like they put themselves in the position to continue what they're doing and win the AFC South.
Jonathan, we appreciate the time. I know it's busy, even though, who knows, maybe you will be busy in round one, or maybe you can kick back and go over to that. You ever been to that Fiesta, that big grocery store right across from the stadium?
I haven't. I know what you're talking about, but I haven't.
The first time I went to NRG Stadium, I'm like, well, look at that. They got this party place right across the street. It's massive. It's called Fiesta. It looks fun. And somebody's like, no, dude, that's just a grocery store chain. I'm like, oh, okay. So you can go over there and get some Fiesta dip and then just watch the first round and then get ready for round two, right?
Yeah, for sure. That sounds like a plan. Thank you for putting that in my mind.
There you go. See, that's what I do, Jonathan. Even from miles away, I come up with just brilliant plans, right, and to accentuate the draft experience. Appreciate the time, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Alexander of the Houston Chronicle.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
By the way, I don't know what made me think of this. I think Thor Nystrom is going to join us NFL Draft Preview. I was just asking this question because every once in a while it's good for me to check in with Eddie and Jimmy to try to maintain my youth. And a couple of years ago, it might have been 2 or 3 years ago, for IndyCar, we were in Nashville for the Nashville race. And we got passes or tickets to go see a band at the amphitheater in Nashville. It was a grand opening of their amphitheater, which is really cool. And the band was good, and the place was absolutely packed. And Michael Young's like, yeah, this is like the band right now. And, I mean, people went crazy over them. And then I've never heard from him since. And I'm like, I don't dispute they were really popular at the time, but I'm like, did the window close already for them? Greta Van Fleet. Eddie, you say that they're like, are they a thing or not a thing?
They're not as popular as they was at that time, that's for sure.
I feel, I have just read up on them, and now I can comfortably say it without embarrassment. I have no idea who that is. No clue.
Couldn't really?
Hard rock, blues rock, progressive rock does not cross through my genre. I cannot tell you.
Probably heard of one of their top hits.
Now, you've not heard of Greta Van Fleet or the Black Crowes, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, I can't help you that way.
Okay.
I'm not a big band guy, to be clear.
Are you waiting for Bach to come to the White River? Or?
I mean, once you've heard the greatest band of all time, the Beatles, I don't know that you need to hear anymore.
The Beatles
that.
Are pretty darn good.
I mean,
there's no doubt about that. That's hard to dispute. Little NFL draft chat, Jimmy?
Yeah, always. Good to talk to our next guest. He is Thor Nystrom, covers all things NFL draft-related as well as the college football ranks with Fantasy Pros. Good to have him back on the program. Thor, happy draft week for you. Thank you again for making the time for us. As always, Eddie took care of you with your Avengers theme out of the gate in a note to the God of Thunder. And as we look at your board for where things stand for the Colts, let's say, for the sake of argument, they want a corner, because we've gone back and forth with this. I'd love Brock Bowers. I don't think he's going to be there. Let's say they want a corner, and they have their eyes set on, let's say, one of the top two corners on the board, like a Terrion Arnold, for example. Do they need to trade up to ensure they get the exact player they want based on that 10 to 15 range?
I think it's in play for, and thanks for having me, guys. I think it's in play for Terrion Arnold to be there for sure. Something you got to monitor, and that's in some ways dependent on how early Quinyon Mitchell goes. Been some talk that maybe the Falcons are considering him as early as 8. Wherever the dance starts at that first cornerback, that would obviously perk the ears up of the Colts. But you can monitor that and sort of in your head modulate the odds that cornerback 2 is going to get to you and see if you believe that you need to potentially trade up. But yeah, the third cornerback certainly would not be off the board by then. But I think there's a very plausible chance that the CB2 is available when the Colts come up on the clock as well.
Okay, so Thor, one of the questions that I've had, and sometimes these things fluctuate as we go through the process, if you will. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that Chris Ballard is sitting there and the clock is ticking at 15 and Bowers is gone. Because I personally believe that if Bowers is on the board, I don't see the Colts passing on him. I don't have anything, and that's just, I can't see how they would. But regardless, if he's sitting there at 15 and he sees a corner that he likes and he sees a receiver that he likes, which one would Chris Ballard be more likely to take if he goes with the theory of, I'm going to pick the one of these that is the harder to replace in round two if I don't get them? Does that make sense what I'm asking?
It does. I think, because you're asking a three-dimensional chess question, and I think that you would lean towards the cornerback position in that scenario. And the reason being is because this receiver class, we talk about the top three guys and talking about how stacked it is, but it's stacked all the way down, and in particular through at least round two, and I believe through early round three, with guys that are plug-and-play immediate starters in the NFL. You can't say the same about the cornerback position of guys that you would feel confident picking and immediately coming in and starting. Maybe you're bullish on the kid, but receiver, you don't debate those guys on that are going to go in the top half of day two there. So I think if you were going to do the three-dimensional chess of those two positions, you would lean cornerback early, and then you take receiver in round two when it is that sweet spot where it is still very talent-rich at that position.
Thor Nystrom is our guest, NFL draft and college football analyst for Fantasy Pros. Thor, going away from the Colts for a second, but it does impact them and impacts really the entire landscape of the league. Earlier today, yet another rich wide receiver contract handed out as the Lions extend Amon-Ra St. Brown, despite the fact that the detractors to that deal say, man, look how deep that this wide receiver draft is. A, how does a move like that impact anything in regards to the position of wide receiver in the 2024 NFL draft? And then secondly, are we approaching an area at wide receiver, maybe not towards the top end of it, but where there is a bubble ready to burst for wide receiver twos and threes as crazy money is continued to be thrown around at that position?
Yeah, there could be a market correction for sure, vis-a-vis the free agency calculations of some of these GMs. I think where you see the manifestation of it topically to what we're talking about now is some inflation we've seen in recent years of the import of wide receivers in the NFL draft. And I think that is a direct acknowledgement of that. Of guys being like, we might have to move on from our receiver. We might have to trade our receiver because of the asking price. And you know, on the other hand, in the NFL draft, we can draft this guy who will start for us for 4 or 5 years and pay him peanuts on the rookie scale. So obviously it's not even near the discrepancy of the quarterback position, the most extreme example of this, but it's getting closer to that. And so you have to start, speaking of three-dimensional chess, you have to start doing that calculation in your head as the decision maker for sure.
Thor Nystrom is our guest talking about the NFL draft. Thor, we haven't really even gone this direction in discussion because it seems so, you know, obviously clear cut. So don't laugh at me for asking this, okay? Is there any world where Chicago is not drafting number one and where Caleb Williams is not going in that spot?
It would be it'd be one of the greatest upsets in sports history if they didn't. I'm here for it. If they turned in a card, you talk about the greatest smokescreen of all time. I think at the sports books yesterday, Caleb Williams is up to something like -200,000 to go first. So, I mean, if Chicago somehow went in a different direction, it would be the U.S. upsetting the Soviet Union in 1980 right. In the Olympics, the Lake Placid, times 10.
And is that because Caleb Williams, you know, obviously, in other words, how big is the gap from Caleb Williams 1 to the rest of the quarterbacks? Because it's going to be a quarterback-heavy draft up top.
Yeah, I mean, I do have Caleb QB1, but I don't think the gap is as big as maybe some others do. And I don't know how seriously Chicago considered some of the other guys, but I think you can make arguments for Jaden Daniels right up there. Certainly different kinds of players, those two guys, when you compare them together. But I don't think that there's an enormous qualitative gap. Like I said, I do have Caleb 1-1 on my board, but not a huge gap. I have Jaden Daniels as number 2 overall on my board, and J.J. McCarthy is number 3 for me. So, and then the fourth guy, May, I have number 8 overall on my board. So I mean, in terms of the gap, I think it was apocryphal when people were tossing out comps to Pat Mahomes with Caleb Williams. They don't play alike. They don't have the same kind of body structure. Like they just have different kinds of games. I think the more middle of the road outcome for Caleb Williams in the NFL is Kyler Murray. And I think the bonanza outcome for him would look more like an Aaron Rodgers.
Now, when you look at the four quarterbacks that you mentioned, and May being behind McCarthy, certainly I think a lot of people 2 months ago would have been surprised by that. But has there been quarterback movement for those guys like up into that spot because they have jumped out so much or because there is such a drop-off after four at quarterback that if you need one, you're going to have to move up to be safe?
Yeah, like as far as my board goes, I think the four guys can justify the top 10 slot with them, the top 8 slot, or even the top 5 slot. I wouldn't argue with that.
So organically, I mean, even if – so do you get what I'm saying? In other words, it's not the it's not lack of quarterback beyond four that is pushing them up a little bit, right?
Yeah, I just think qualitatively, obviously you have to take a little more chance with that position because like we were talking about before with the discrepancy of the ROI you can get on the rookie scale contract if you get a star there against what you should be paying that guy becomes the cheat code bonanza if you get a star at that position. So you have to shoulder a little bit more risk, and that's why those guys, if they do project to potentially become an NFL star at that position, that's why the juice justifies the squeeze with that top 10 selection. I do think the train stops at four as far as guys at that position that you can make that argument for. To me, Bo Nix is an early second-round guy, and I have Rattler and Nix both as third-rounders in this class.
Thor Nystrom is our guest, covers all things college football as well as NFL draft expert for Fantasy Pros. Thor, there's been rumblings locally, and we're getting to that point where you never know what is rumor, what is real, but speculation is that perhaps if the right guy fell, that Chris Ballard would try for the 25th year, I kid, in a row to try to land the proper edge rusher for what he wants the Colts to be as a defensive unit. If, hypothetically speaking, and there's a lot of needs the Colts have, no doubt they need help in their cornerback department, they need another weapon for Anthony Richardson, and sure, I suppose, if it was there, another edge rusher might finally do the trick for them up front. If it was between, let's just say, three prospects, Dallas Turner, Brian Anderson Jr., and Nate Wiggins, who projects better professionally, and who do you envision, albeit I know it's not directly your market, being a better fit for the Colts if that's taking place at 15?
The second one, who was the second guy?
Nate Wiggins. Brian Thomas Jr. out of LSU.
Oh, yeah. So of those guys, man, you would have an argument on your hands. I think I do have Dallas Turner slightly ahead of the other two, but it's pretty close. I'm a little bit lower on Dallas Turner than some others. I mean, speaking of the betting market, just a week ago, Dallas Turner was the prohibitive favorite against the entire field to be the first defender off the board, something that I vociferously disagreed with. The odds have slightly changed since then, but I think it's a bit overstated. I prefer a lot to, certainly if he's healthy and then even versed to Turner. I think it presents a possibility Turner falls down a little bit. He just needs some more work on his game. The athletic tools are obviously all there. He's got the long arms and everything. He has some pass rushing moves. Just needs to flesh that out a little bit more and add some more strength. I saw a guy who was running around college tackles quite a bit. But like I said, that might cause him to lose some tiebreakers up there at the top. Could facilitate him dropping down a little bit, say, into the Colts slot. I love the fit of Brian Thomas Jr. to the Colts. I was doing that in a whole bunch of mocks, you know, going back a month and a half. I just think it's such a perfect stylistic match with the Colts and what they're looking for, and the spacing problem that a guy like Anthony Richardson presents to opposing defenses. If you also have a guy that you know is going to win downfield each time when he rears back and chucks it up when it's one-on-one, that's, we know that Brian Thomas can do that. We don't know if he can do the rest of the stuff because his one-year breakout, it was just destroying people downfield over and over and over again. The rest of his game has to be fleshed out, but at minimum, you get a really good pop-to-top wide receiver two in the NFL that creates spacing problems for the defense. And because of Anthony Richardson being the quarterback and his ability to just steal yards at will when the defense does not have proper spacing once it's not there, I think that that's a good fit as well. But for me, that would be between those two guys. That decision would come down to Thomas against Turner.
See, I'm telling you, Thomas to me is the guy that, I mean, I'm with you, Thor, on that. Like, I just think he fits perfectly. But let me ask you what we were discussing earlier in a different conversation. Thor Nystrom, our guest, talking about the NFL draft. Is there a player maybe that you've already mentioned? I mean, obviously Marvin Harrison Jr. is going to be the answer here, but realistically, if the Colts are looking at it and Chris Ballard is saying, look, corner or offensive space playmaker, those are the two things that are my big need here. Is there a player that if he is available at 15, you know, realistically could be available at 15, that jumps out and you say that guy is so clearly best player available that Ballard is going to be tempted to take him even though it doesn't fit the narrative of their immediate need?
Yeah, I mean, Bowers, you know, being brought up before, if he were to fall down there, certainly. And the only other possibility where it would be like no doubt would be in the stunning scenario if Rome Odunze fell down there. I do think that it is more in play than people think that Rome Odunze gets to number 10. I would be very surprised if he gets past number 10. That is where the Jets are sitting.
He didn't get past 15 if he's available, right?
No. That would be if he somehow got to 15, that is the turn the card in immediately. It doesn't matter. Just be ready with that card right away when you come onto the clock. But I think those are the two guys. The other ones, you know, like I said, the receiver class, very, very good. But after those top three guys, you know, you have, you know, whether it's Thomas, whether it's McConkey, you know, these other guys, it's more of you have the drop in the tier and then the discussion between the other guys. And then you have that super deep round two thing. And then, you know, outside of Bowers, you have a huge drop after that in tight ends. And obviously no running back deserves to go up, in my opinion, top 50 in this class. So those would be it would be one of those two scenarios, Bowers being the far more realistic one.
Thor, what are you looking at from a cost standpoint if a team was to trade up, let's say, five spots, and we'll use the Colts since I know there's a lot of parameters here, to up like 15 to 11 versus 15 to 8 in today's draft era? What are you looking at from a cost standpoint? Let's just say it's just picks involved.
So going, can you run me through that one more time?
So let's say the Colts would trade up 15 to 10 versus 15 to 7, and the trade is just draft capital. Can be future draft capital, but just draft capital. What are you looking at to move up, say, for the Colts, four spots versus, you know, six or seven?
By the trade chart, to get up to five spots, you're looking at roughly, it's the equivalent value of an early third round, late second round kind of a pick. And you could mix and match depending on what you got. Maybe it's multiple picks that equal that qualitatively, but that is roughly the value the other team's going to be asking back when you make that call.
When you look at this year's draft class, draft scenarios, Thor Nystrom is our guest. You're obviously with Fantasy Pros, NFL Draft College Football Analyst there, but also doing work with Betting Pros. Is there a selection that you have that is as yet to be maybe oversaturated by the market, or there's still value that you feel confident in placing a wager on going into Thursday?
1,000%. Yeah, you know, I mentioned the first defender off the board before. I've been fading Dallas Turner on that. The long shots that I took, one of them is still a big long shot, is Quinyon Mitchell, because I heard that Atlanta's going to lead the dance, I think, with the first defender if they don't trade down. And they've been sniffing around the cornerbacks a little bit more than I think people are baking into their mock drafts. But also Latu is right there with Turner. And then the other dark horse, his odds have come crashing down. I think the whales in the market sniff this one out. That's Byron Murphy. And particularly if the Falcons, you know, let's say a scenario where like the QB4 somehow gets through the wickets of the Giants, and then a team like the Vikings is able to trade to 8 and grab that QB4, that would mean that the first 8 guys off the board were all offensive players, and means that Chicago would be on the clock then. I think that Chicago is looking, they're the team that I think could surprise people by passing on Rome Odunze to add to their defense. That's what I've been hearing that they're leaning towards right now with that number 9 pick. And they would be looking potentially at Byron Murphy. I know that Chicago's interested in him. So those are a couple I have faded Drake May throughout this process as a top three pick. Both the second pick, I'm not sure how bettable that is right now at the current numbers, but Jaden Daniels, the plus money stuff with him at number two before that, the odds have obviously flipped on that. But I also have a lot of action on J.J. McCarthy either at two or at three. And those things I think are still bettable. J.J. McCarthy in the market right now, his over-under slot is 5.5. So I've gone under with that. The one other one that's sort of outside the box, but one to consider, the two of them with regards to the offensive line class, the Chargers, if they stick and pick at five, if they're stuck there, obviously they're a trade down possibility. But if they're stuck there, I buy the stuff that Daniel Jeremiah put out yesterday about they may prefer Latham, J.C. Latham from Alabama to Joe Alt. They might be the only organization that might prefer that way, but because of the way that Jim Harbaugh prefers to build his offensive lines, J.C. Latham is a bully of a north-south run blocker, and that's what Jim Harbaugh wants to build from that and start with that foot going forward. So that's a possibility. The one I'm a little bit more bullish on is the Titans at seven. The Titans badly need a left tackle. It's not a tackle. It is a left tackle because they know that Will Levis, the thing where he starts glitching, it's with the blindside pressure. And he has all the tools. You need to keep that. It's imperative. You need to keep that blindside clean for him. If you don't, you're not really giving him a fair chance because we know that that is like the bugaboo of his game. Right now, the Titans starting tackles are travesties, but, in particular, the quality of the projected starting left tackle right now. If Alt goes off the board above, like if I'm wrong about the other thing, then he's not available to the Titans. They could do something very interesting at number seven. If they aren't confident that they could trade down and get a guy that can step in immediately at left tackle. When Alt goes off the board, there's only two other guys that you could project potentially to go immediately in at left tackle. It's Fashanu and Fatanu. And Fatanu, he's polarizing with this within NFL circles. Fashanu from Penn State, he is the dead red left tackle prospect guy. And the thing he is really good at is pass blocking. The reason he is polarizing in NFL circles is the run blocking and the power and the stuff going forward with his game, not the natural feel that he has for pass protection. But the thing that you're prioritizing, if you're the Titans, of course, it's the blindside pass protection, which for Fashanu, that's the thing that he projects the best at. So he's the guy that I could see the Titans pulling up the board and going a little bit before people out there expect him to go.
Thor, if former Indiana quarterback Michael Penix Jr. gets invited by friends to go to a movie tomorrow night, is he safe to go to it?
And the NFL makes egregious mistakes all the time, so I can't put it past them to take, either Penix or Bonix in the first round. I think that that's exactly what it would be, though. With Penix, at least, I think it's far more – you can sell that more. You can make the argument more, certainly in the late first round. I have Penix as an early second rounder on my board, something like 40 around there. The arm talent justifies it. And as you guys know, everyone, the last couple of years when they started watching him at Washington, that the arm talent that he has is pretty obvious. But you guys know that he also is a very, very good athlete, which he proved during the pre-draft process. It's just I don't know that that's going to manifest much in the NFL for the same reason that people are surprised to see it at the pro day. Because the last two years, I'm pretty sure that Kalen DeBoer told him to stay within the pocket because of the four straight season-ending injuries when he was at Indiana, when he was making those plays outside the pocket, when he was during the COVID season reaching out over the goal line to beat Penn State, upset them, and all those different kind of things he did earlier in his career. Was a very cool element of his game, but we saw that it led to injuries over and over again. I think it's going to be a similar thing in the NFL. And the other thing is Penix's accuracy begins to depreciate more and more. The more his feet are moving, the more you can push him off his spot. And the reason for that is he has all that upper body action in his throwing motion, doesn't use the lower half as much, doesn't use the core as much. He just uses that as sort of the steady platform to throw off of. Like a sniper uses that for balance of, when he's aiming. And so for those reasons, I don't think you can bake that stuff in. But for me, early second rounder.
Thor, listen, I'm going to make this comment and then retreat off the stage quickly. You ready? Michael Penix's athleticism at Indiana allowed him to get a half an inch from the goal line against Penn State, but he was close enough they gave it to him anyway.
Wow. Well, it was a very cool moment. I remember watching that. It was a very cool moment. And it was Rise Up Hoosier Nation that day, all around America.
Yeah.
They call a touchdown that day. That's all I know, baby.
It was a conversion, wasn't it?
Was it a touchdown? Yeah, it was 2 points. You're right. It was 2 points. Yeah. You're right.
He was actually kind of short, but that's okay.
Thor, I'm on the scoreboard. That's all that matters.
That's right. And they're not going to do what they did to Reggie Bush or, you know, Joseph Newgarden and come back and go, you know what? Actually, we made a mistake. Thor, I know you've got to be slammed, man. Enjoy the caffeine over the next couple of hours, next couple of days, and soak it all in. Your time to shine, so we appreciate the time.
Thanks so much, guys. We'll see you on the other side.
All right, there you go. Thor Nystrom talking about the NFL draft, which gets underway tomorrow.